We left off last week. We completed the whole story of Jericho. I just want to we didn't really deal with the last verse of chapter six. Here it is. The last verse of chapter six. Well, actually, it's the second last verse. But that's another thing about the way these divisions are. Okay. At that time, Joshua pronounced this oath, "Cursed of the Lord be the man who shall undertake to rebuild this city of Jericho. He shall lay its foundations at the cost of his firstborn and set up its gates at the cost of his youngest." So there is this incredible statement, a curse actually, that Joshua makes, that Jericho needs to be destroyed forever, which we already read last week. But here it says that anyone who actually builds the city, rebuilds the city, will pay for it with the death of his children. And I just wanted to refer to you where this actually happens later on. In 1 Kings chapter 16, we learn about Ahab. We are introduced to Ahab. And we know, of course, that Ahab was not a very good guy. And we learn in the very end of chapter 16, we learn that Ahab built up the Asherah, which is a type of idolatry. He builds up he creates the Asherah. And it says that Ahab did all kinds of terrible things to provoke the Lord God of Israel. It wasn't just that Ahab wasn't in the mood to do good things, but he was doing things almost on purpose to make God angry. Not almost, exactly, on purpose to make God angry more than any other king of Israel before him. That's what the verse tells us. And then we learn in verse 34, in his days, Chiel from Beit El built up Jericho, and he lost his firstborn son, Abiram, with this foundation, and his youngest son, Seguv, when he put on its doors. As God had said, as Joshua, son of Nun, had said. Okay, so first of all, we have here divine retribution on the basis of Joshua's curse. And this is exactly what happens, that these two people, we don't know anything about them. They are not related to Ahab. All we know is that they are in the time of Ahab, and they rebuild Jericho, and they are, and this fellow who rebuilds Jericho loses both of his sons as a result, as a punishment. Now, I would just comment, first of all, we could see it's very interesting, of course, that Joshua makes this curse, and you know, generations later, we see this happening, playing out in 1 Kings and referring back. So it's very tidy and very neat. But I think there is additional significance here. First of all, we do know that, I will restate the verses in Kings. We're 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 33 and 34. What's interesting here is that it begins with introducing Ahab and how steeped in idolatry Ahab was, okay? And that's very, very relevant to our story, because what were we talking about Jericho? One of the things we ended up with last week was we talked about how this idea of destroying an entire city, men, women, children, and not being allowed to touch any of the spoils, but burning it all, this is something that is way beyond what was part of the original instruction on how to capture a city in the land of Israel. And it is, it reminds us, is very similar to the story of a city in Israel, when the entire city is taken over or becomes immersed in idolatry. And in that same way, a city like that, you destroy every person in it and all of everything and the property and everything is burnt. Okay. And here we have this rebuilding of Jericho. Jericho, that city that is symbolic of a city steeped in pagan worship, a city that whose very king calls out to defy God. He is this first Canaanite king that is going to close up his city and fight against God, as we discussed last week. It's very relevant that in the time of Ahab, when Ahab, on purpose to defy God, goes out of his way to bring in pagan worship, and scripture tells about him that he defies God more than any other king before him. It is no coincidence, I believe, that it is in his time that you have this individual deciding to go out and build Jericho. It's coming from the same place. I will defy God. I will defy this, not just some curse. I will defy God. I will defy the very destruction of pagan worship that the destruction of Jericho represented. I am going to defy that. Now, once Jericho is rebuilt, we do know in Jewish history that Jericho, especially during the Second Temple period, is a place where Jews lived. It was a city. It was nothing wrong once the place was rebuilt, and then it becomes a city and it's rebuilt very differently, and there is no pagan worship there afterwards. I'm not talking about during the time of Ahab. I'm talking about much later. Okay, so Jericho does not become a place that you can't walk into anymore. Okay, but it was this act of rebuilding as an act of defiance is what Joshua cursed, and it is actually that kind of act of defiance in rebuilding Jericho, to defy what happened to Jericho, that we see in this story during the time of Ahab. Okay, so that really closes the story of Jericho. And now we are gonna move on. Well, we're gonna move on to the story of the Ai. But let's begin first with chapter seven. Although again, I get confused because of the way the paragraphing looks. Okay, so the last verse of chapter six is again, the way the paragraphs are set up in the Hebrew tradition, in the Jewish tradition, is that the last verse of chapter six is actually part and parcel of the first verse in chapter seven. So let's read them together. The Lord was with Joshua, and his name spread throughout the land. The Israelites, however, violated the proscription. Again, here we have that word cherem. We're going to be dealing with it again this time. Achan, son of Carmi, son of Zabdi, son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, took of that which was prescribed, and the Lord was incensed with the Israelites. And I'm putting these two verses together because we have a contrast going on here. On the one hand, we learn as a result of this, this amazing miracle of Jericho, we learn that this has just sanctified God's name, and has also the idea that God is with Joshua, that message has gone out over the land. God is great and God is with Joshua. Beware of Joshua, he's God's man, okay? So you have this amazing effect that has been created by this miraculous battle at Joshua. And yet the very next sentence, we have the exact opposite. We have the children of Israel taking from the cherem, taking from those spoils that were prescribed. Now remember, all that stuff from Jericho was put aside. It was supposed to belong to God. It was not supposed to be taken by anybody. And yet we have first a sentence that says, as if the entire nation took part in this taking from the cherem. And then we learn that it really isn't the entire nation. It is one man whose name is Achan. And yet God is mad at all of Israel. That's an introduction. Now, at this point in time, of course, Israel doesn't know that anyone's mad at them, that God's mad at them. And Achan doesn't know that God is mad at him. And Joshua doesn't know that God is mad at anybody. Okay. That is only something that we will discover and they will discover later. Okay. So then we have the beginning of the battle for the Ai. And I want to just point out certain specific things here, because we will see how relevant they become afterwards. One thing I just want to remind you again, based on the kinds of stuff we were talking about last week, when we talked about the word cherem and how the cherem is translated as being a prescription, but it's also a proscription, something forbidden, but it also is a word that's used to refer to exterminate and to destroy. And what we're going to see here in this whole story, the cherem itself is the body of stuff, of possessions, that is the loot or whatever you want to call it, that is supposed to be set aside as holy for God. It belongs to God. those who steal from that pile are stealing from the cherem, okay? Those who steal from the cherem, though, will end up being destroyed, okay? Which, if we remember, that's another use of the word cherem. So we have, again, here, like we began discussing last week, this ongoing juxtaposition between what is holy and should have been set aside and what happens to people that disturb that, that take what is not there, that partake of the holy, which doesn't belong to them, and then they will be destroyed. And so we have that play with the word cherem going on throughout this story. Okay, so let's see how this progresses. So Joshua, from his perspective, he thinks everything's fine, and he's going to prepare this war for the Ai. And he sends some people out, go check it out, bring us back a report. Okay, verse 3, they come back to Joshua and they say to him, what do they say to him? Don't bother sending all the nation. It's a waste. This is going to be easy. These people in the Ai, they're half asleep. They don't know what's going to hit them. Don't waste more than 2,000-3,000 people. That's it. That's all we need. It's going to be easy. And Joshua trusts these people. And he says, okay. All right. So they take 3,000 people and they go and they just do this frontal attack. They like just walk into Ai, you know, no plans, no strategy, not very many people, 3,000 people. And they just go into Ai and they think, oh, this is going to be great. But as they're approaching Ai, they got caught, right? The people in Ai see them. They chase after them. They slaughter a whole bunch of them. And the rest of them run away, fearful for their lives. And at that point, terrible, terrible crisis. Because first of all, Joshua doesn't know what happened. You know, he's saying, oh my gosh, I thought we're on a roll. You know, we're right after Jericho. Like, what's going on? What happened? And he is feeling terrible. And then he turns to God, Joshua, and he says, why did you bother bringing us across the Jordan? If this is what's going to happen, we should have just stayed on the other side of the Jordan. I mean, like when I read this verse now, I was frankly a bit shocked, because this reminded me of the kind of complaining that we heard from the children of Israel in the desert under Moses. Every time something goes wrong, instead of sitting back and saying, okay, let's see what God has in mind, they start complaining and they say to Moses, oh, we remember the watermelons and the fish and, you know, the zucchini and all the wonderful stuff that we had in Egypt. And why did you bother taking us out of Egypt? Which, of course, is such a crazy perspective, because there were slaves in Egypt. It's really, you know, rosy eye, you know, hindsight. It's so divorced from reality. But it was, you know, you can say they were still in a slave mentality. They didn't have the strength of character, independent spirit to realize that, no, you know, we can withstand this. Let's wait and see what God has in mind. So you think that they've gotten over this. But here it's not just the nation. It's Joshua. Joshua, who you would expect more of. Okay. And yet he seems to also be in that situation. But then in his next sentence, he kind of corrects himself. Okay. And you see that what he really is talking about here, he's not talking about, you know, I'm so defeated and I'm having a hard time and I can't deal with the challenges. What he is saying is, if we were going to be in a situation that would actually create a desecration of God's name, you have this amazing victory in Jericho. And we learned that, you know, right at the beginning in the last verse of chapter 6, you know, God was with Joshua and the reputation went all over the land. So you came out of Jericho with this amazing reputation. God is God and he's with Joshua. And so Joshua says, if you're going to ruin that, if you're going to ruin this and you're going to create a desecration of your name, what was the point? And that is not the same as what the children of Israel were complaining about. Because here, what Joshua is really saying is he's concerned for God's name and for, you know, what is the ultimate purpose here? And it's a normal question. And you can see that God responds to him and he's not at all angry with him. In fact, he says, get up, Joshua. Why are you, you know, you shouldn't be so upset. He says, you're good. You're fine. He says, but Israel has sinned. Now look what he says what God says to Joshua in verse 11. Israel has sinned. They have transgressed my covenant, which I have commanded to them. And they also took from the cherem. They took from those prescribed goods, and they stole, and they denied, and they put it in their possessions, in their dishes, in their vessels. Okay? And so then he basically is saying, explains in verse 12, that as a result of this, the children of Israel could not possibly stand up to their enemies. They would be running from their enemies. Why? Because they were becoming a cherem. In other words, basically what God is saying, again, using that word cherem in two different ways. They help themselves to these goods that were supposed to be holy for God. And as a result, they are now in a situation of death. Okay? They are doomed to death. They took from the cherem, and therefore they are doomed for extermination, which is why God is not saving them. This is why that they were slaughtered like that. Okay? He says, because I will not continue to be with them. And he goes on to give Joshua instruction that in order to save the situation, they have to find the actual person who stole from the cherem, who stole from these goods. Okay. And then, of course, they go and then in verse 13, we continue the instruction, sanctify the nation, tell them to sanctify themselves for tomorrow, because there is a cherem within you, okay? There's this terrible thing that's going on within you. What's the cherem? It's the goods themselves, but it's the fact that the goods have been taken from the holiness into the nation. Someone's holding on to these holy goods. And as a result, nothing can happen until you're not going to be able to withstand your enemies until this is removed, okay? But here, we talked last week about this juxtaposition of the holy and the need for, and the extermination, and here we have this placed right in front of us, that the holiness, it is the nation has to sanctify themselves. They have to enter into holiness in order to solve the problem. If they're going to go and find this cherem and put it back to where it belongs, do with it what it's supposed to do, they themselves have to become holy, okay? And then God says, whoever actually was caught with this, he will be burnt and everything with him, because he transgressed the covenant. And of course, they go through this whole system where there's kind of like a lots or whatever, and they narrow it down, and they figure out that it is indeed Achan who did this. And when they catch him, Joshua confronts him and he answers. He says, and this is like what's so amazing to me. He answers, this is in verse 21. He says, you're right. He says, but I saw these beautiful things and I wanted them. I coveted them. I wanted them. And he took them and he buried them. And of course, then they find it all and they bring it out and put it all together and burn it all, because it's including Achan. Okay, he burned, and they also stoned him, and so he is killed for his sin, but all the property, everything is burnt, and the animals and everything, it's all burnt, because it is for Israel, for God. It's not supposed to be for human beings. They're not supposed to be enjoying this kind of thing. So first question I would want to deal with here is, what does this have to do with transgressing the covenant? We understand that there was a rule that they could not touch any of these spoils, and that was supposed to be set aside for God. And here's this one guy who really, did a wrong thing for a stupid reason, what does that have to do with transgressing the covenant? What does that have to do with the covenant? He disobeyed this particular instruction. Why does God take this whole picture and put it in terms of there's a problem here with the covenant? That's my first question. And the second question is, why is the entire nation punished? It becomes clear in this story, as the story progresses in chapter 7, it becomes clear that there's only one guy who took these spoils, Achan, no one else. So why is God angry at the entire nation? And why is it that when they went up against the people of the AI for the first time, all these people were killed, and it had just affected everybody for one person. Okay, what was going on here? So first of all, I want to talk about, this is the first question, what does this have to do with the covenant? Now, I think that, what is the covenant, first of all? The covenant between God and the people of Israel is the covenant we have in a few different places. The covenant we have in Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy 27, 28. We also have a similar covenant in Leviticus. And actually, the covenant that's in Deuteronomy 27, 28, they will actually be renewing that covenant very soon, like in the next chapter, chapter 8. And we're going to discuss that. Okay, but what is this covenant? Basically, the covenant is God gives the nation of Israel the land of Israel. God makes the nation of Israel his people. And the nation of Israel obeys God and follows all his commandments. That's the deal, okay? And if one side of this covenant is broken, if the nation of Israel does not obey the commandments, then they don't deserve the land. And it's not just a deal, okay? It's all part of the relationship. The covenant between God and the nation of Israel is a relationship that has these different pieces in it, the land, the people, and the word of God, the commandments, okay? Now, what happens is that they come in to conquer the land. It is very, very important that the conquest of the land is not about power. It is not about money. It's not about normal motivations of people when they come to conquer a land. Typically, it's, and here, you know, one of the things that historically people try to say, was there really a Joshua? Was there, you know, archaeologists and historians, was there really an entry to the land of Israel? And there is some evidence that there was this ragtag band of tribes that kind of came into the land around that time and settled, and like historians don't really know what to do with this, and they think, well, maybe that is what the Bible is talking about. But there's a good reason why historians don't really know what to do with this, because it is very unusual for a group of people, like the way the children of Israel would have been at the time, recently released from slavery, having spent 40 years in the desert. Now, nothing about what we read in the Bible about what was going on in the desert tells us about military training. They had a few military encounters, no question, but we don't see them spending 40 years in the desert building an army and doing maneuvers and organizing and building up their strength or anything like that. It is very clear that the lion's share of the preparation of going into the land of Israel has to do with obeying God, following God's commandments, okay? We are not talking about the Babylonian Empire that conquered the Assyrian Empire, okay, which is how history normally moves. In this case, we have literally a ragtag group of tribes that come into a land, take on Canaanite kings, far more powerful and more sophisticated than they are, and somehow defeat them. Well, this is not a power struggle. This is about covenant. The nation of Israel is coming into the land of Israel in fulfillment of covenant. And therefore, when they battle Jericho, it has nothing to do with them. There's no battle. There's trumpets. And there's you know, an angel. And the walls come tumbling down. And there's very little that the nation has to do because God is handing it to them. What happens when they then go and help themselves to the spoils? They are essentially saying, or what Achan is saying, is, I wanted it. I wanted it. It was mine. I stole it from somebody. Now, you can't steal from God. But to him, it was spoils of a war. I can steal from spoils. Okay, I'm not supposed to touch it, but okay. All right, so it doesn't really belong to me, but I'm going to take it. If he really understood that this was God's and that this war had nothing to do with him, like when people take spoils from a war, it's because they say, we deserved it. We worked hard. We conquered the enemy. We did this for the king. We did this for ourselves, for our families, whatever. We did it. We did it. Therefore, we're coming back with the spoils of war. And in fact, in ancient times, they would come back with the spoils of war, and there would be victory parades where they would show, flash the gold and the silver and the slaves. And this would become part of the victory march that said, oh, we're great. We did it. Okay. Now, in a situation like this battle for Jericho, there's no room whatsoever for anyone in the nation of Israel to say, we did it. We were great. And so what we're seeing here in Achan's taking these spoils is essentially it's breaking the covenant at its most basic level, because it's saying, this is not part of a relationship with God. This is not me taking possession of something God is giving me miraculously. I did it. I like these gold and silver things, and I covet it, and I want it. I'm going to take it. I'm going to bury it. Okay. The very fact that this kind of way of looking at it enters his mind means that there's a real problem here. But how does this affect the whole nation? Why are they also seen as having broken the covenant? And why are they also punished for what one man did? And here, and this I'm really relying on a teaching that I actually had from a very well-known Bible teacher here in Israel, by Samet, who I studied with for many years. He says, he gives a whole perspective on this, which I think is absolutely brilliant. And he says, look at all of this. In addition to what I've said until now, he also says it's all about arrogance. Okay. It wasn't just about arrogance in this one Achan, but essentially the whole nation sinned with the same sin of arrogance, seeing the victory of Jericho as our victory. And how do we know that? We know that because at the very beginning of chapter 7, when Joshua sends the spies into the Ai and come back with a report, what do they say? It's easy. 2,000-3,000 people, and we're going to do it. What does this tell you? They came out of Jericho and they say, we did it. It was really easy. So I'm going to go to Ai. It's not much bigger than Jericho. What's the big deal? We don't need everybody. They're 2,000-3,000 and we do it. And they just go. So first of all, they completely underestimate the enemy. Okay, you just don't walk on a city and say, okay, we're taking you over. When you underestimate your enemy, you overestimate yourself. And they overestimated themselves because they came out of this high from Jericho and they forgot one little piece, that Jericho was all about God. They broke the covenant because they forgot that everything about what they were doing was about a covenant, was about God giving the land to the nation of Israel. It wasn't about the nation of Israel being so powerful or special or whatever. And that, when you turn, and basically what was going on here then, not just that they were arrogant, but if in the course of this arrogance, they were going to go forward and capture the Ai or go forward into battle, they were going to be turning what should have been a conquest of the land in fulfillment of covenant into a conquest of the land like any other conquest. Power, wealth, you know, becoming the empire, the new empire of the region. And that is not the message. That will create the ultimate desecration of God's name. You take God out of the picture, it all becomes about power and wealth, and then you don't deserve the land. You just don't deserve it because you don't realize that you're getting it by God's gift, not because you're powerful and you're good and you know how to fight a war. And that then was the fundamental problem that created the failure in the Ai. Not just that one man helped himself to the spoils, but there was an overwhelming sense of arrogance as a result of the success in Jericho that poisoned the way they approached the battle to the Ai. And you could see that also in a most practical way. Because of, as I said, the 3,000 people, and they just went. But if you go then look at chapter 8, when they redo the battle, and this time successfully, all of a sudden, Joshua says, no, we're going to redo this. He ignores what those other people said, and he realizes, number one, there's no place for arrogance. Now, this is not going to be a battle like Jericho. God makes it very clear, okay, this is not a battle that, the walls are going to come tumbling down. God says in chapter 8, he says, don't be afraid. Okay, take with you the entire nation to war. Go up to the Ai. See, I will give it in your hands, the king of the Ai, his nation, his city, and his land. Okay? But it's very clear. He says afterwards, at the end of the verse 2, he says, place an ambush around the city. Okay? Place an ambush around the city. What is he basically saying to Joshua? I'm not going to fight this battle for you. I'm going to be there. I'm going to help you. But you've got to fight the battle with normal human means, which means sit back, take stock of the situation, and plan. Don't underestimate your enemy. And indeed, what he does is he takes a huge army. He divides it up. He uses a decoy team to get the nation, to get those people chasing after them. Empties the city, has another group of people coming in, capturing the city, another group of people ready to fight the people who've run out of the Ai. It's a very complicated strategy. It's a strategy that indicates we have to be prepared. We cannot take anything for granted. But at the same point, we have something that's very, very significant. And that is in chapter 8, verse 18. Okay, just as about they're going to, you know, right there in the middle of the battle. Okay, God says to Joshua, take the spear that is in your hand and stretch it out towards the city, towards the Ai. And that's what he does. And then we learn in verse 26 that Joshua kept his hand out there with his spear until they had completely destroyed the city of Ai. Now, of course, this reminds us of the angel that we met right before the battle of Jericho. There he had a sword in his hand. Here he has a spear in his hand. Okay. But there's a huge difference here. There it was an angel. Here it was Joshua. That battle was an angel battle. It was a total miracle battle. Here, that spear is kind of handed to Joshua. Okay, your first battle, I did it all for you. Now this next battle, you're going to have to do it. It's a real battle. But there's something supernatural about the way you're going to be helped. And that is represented by Joshua holding that spear over the city. But also reminded me of something else. Remember back in Exodus, right after they came out of Egypt, right after the parting of the Red Sea, they're attacked by Amalek in Rephidim. Okay. And they go to war with Amalek. And what happens? Yeah. Joshua is down below. He, at this point, is the general. He's fighting the war. Moses is up on the hill holding up his hands.
Yes.
And for as long as his hands are up, they will win. Okay. Again, we have this idea of someone stretching out their hands, representing God's shielding and protection over this battle. Then Joshua was the general. Now Joshua is the Moses holding out his hand over the Ai. So we see here a lot of parallels, but I think the corrected version of the Battle of the Ai tells us everything that is done right in contrast to the way it was done initially. There's no arrogance. There's real planning. They take their enemy seriously. They understand that God will protect them, but they have to do their part, okay? And the battle has transferred from a complete miracle kind of battle to a battle that is a physical, real battle with human strategy involved, but at the same time, God's protection represented by that spear that is held over the city. That's today's teaching on Joshua. Any questions? Thank you.
Very good. Very good.
Thank you. I like
this. Yes, thank you. This has been a very different slant on the way I have read it before. It's just very good.
Appreciate you. Sandra, yes. Regarding the walls of Jericho, is there an evidence that Joshua was there? I had a tour guide tell me that you can actually tell from archaeological evidence that the way the walls fell, if they had fallen inward, they wouldn't have been able to climb up and in, but if they fell outward, it made it easier for them to take the city.
It could be, but I just don't know anything about that. Jericho has been in the hands of the Palestinian Authority for many years now. I remember going to Jericho years and years ago, but you know, way before.
It was there. Tour guide told us that he I couldn't tell. It just looked like a pile of rubble.
Well, but when were you there? When were you in Jericho?
At least to the year 2000.
After the year 2000?
In the year 2000.
Ah, because that was already kind of out of bounds, but it could be the tourists were able to go there.
We did.
We were not able to go there. Now, there are parts of Jericho now where some of the ruins are and stuff that you can go today with special permission or whatever, but I have not gone. And I don't know if you can go to the areas where the walls are. Some foreign tourists can, but we as Israelis can't. Anyway, I just don't know very much about it, but it sounds fascinating. One of these days, maybe we'll all take a tour in Jericho. Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
Sandra,
yes.
When I was looking at this last week and looked up, I use Strong's Concordance, and when I looked up the meaning of the walls falling flat, it said that it comes from a primitive root that means to depress. So the image I got then was that the walls were pressed down into the ground. Able to go straight up in front of them because the walls had virtually disappeared, which would explain why Rahab's house that was built on the wall would have ended up just flat on the ground like an ordinary house.
Her house had to have been standing because the instructions
I don't mean it was knocked down. I meant that if it was on the wall and the wall was pressed down into the ground, then her house would end up on the ground like anybody else's house. I don't mean deflated.
I don't know. Because you have this, the spies initially tell her she has to stay indoors.
Get her. Yeah.
So I can't imagine that her house actually collapsed, but I don't know.
No, I don't mean that it collapsed.
I mean that
if it was on the wall, and the wall was pressed down into the ground, then her house would stay upright.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. In other words, her house is attached to the wall, so the wall comes down, but her house stays.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's possible.
I'm trying to find where it talks about. Where does it talk about the wall being flat? At least flat is the English word that's used.
Let's see.
So the earth sort of swallowed the wall.
Yes.
Verse 20, it says the wall collapsed.
Collapsed underneath. No, it doesn't. Vatipol just means fall. That word just means fall. The wall fell underneath it. That's what it is. It fell underneath it. So it's like it kind of get this shrinking down or something. I don't know. I don't know.
That's,
it wasn't there.
That's the place where the verb is explained or the word is explained as coming from an original meaning to depress.
Well, it's fall, but yeah.
Yeah.
It's not bending forward, it's falling. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever. Anyway, this was a great discussion. Good to see you all, and I will look forward to seeing you all next week.
Hi.
Okay.
Bye bye.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
My pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that video. And we'd like to be sure you're getting all of our video content. So just click on the subscribe button below as well as on the notification bell. And that way you will have easy access to all our material. We look forward to staying in touch with you. God bless you and have a wonderful day.